United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session. Please be seated.
All right, well, good morning, everyone. I want to welcome all counsel who are appearing before us. We thank you for being here virtually, and we look forward to hearing all of your arguments this morning. It's a privilege to be sitting with my colleague, Judge Bumate, this week, and Judge Bumate and I would like to say a special thank you and welcome to our good friend, Judge Lasnik, from the Western District of Washington, who's sitting with us by designation. He does this frequently for us. Judge Lasnik, it's great to have you back.
Thank you so much.
So for counsel who are arguing this morning, appellants, please feel free to reserve time for rebuttal. It's up to you to watch the clock. We have three cases that were submitted on the briefs, and we'll turn to our argument calendar this morning. And the first case we have is Quintero versus Ford Motor Company, which is case 2558833. And we'll be pleased to hear from the appellants.
May it please the court, my name is Cindy Tobisman here on behalf of the appellants. This appeal turns on whether a plaintiff's election of remedy at the time of submitting a proposed judgment that the court directed it to prepare constitutes an abandonment of their implied warranty claim. I think there's no question that there's no abandonment here. This isn't an instance where a party refused to litigate a claim. Quite the contrary, plaintiffs litigated their claim all the way to verdict. They submitted a judgment that embodied that verdict, that stated that they had won on that claim. And the only election would have been essentially a conditional election to take under a different verdict with a higher dollar number. And it's conditional because it really only needed to happen if there was a chance that they could have taken under both. The nature of the election of remedies doctrine is essentially an estoppel principle. The idea is that you made the other side, you made the defendant change position in some way that they've been injured. There's no way that Ford was injured in this case. They litigated the claim all the way along, same as we did, got all the way down to verdict. The act of electing between two different monetary amounts isn't an election of a claim. It's a choice of a remedy. The idea that would be an abandonment of a claim, that would be a knowing relinquishment of the right to recover is sort of absurd. And frankly, this is one of those cases where you kind of wonder, what would plaintiff's counsel have done differently all the way along?
Well, one question is, why was the implied warranty included in the proposed judgment? Because if you were going to elect based on the express warranty claim, why was the implied warranty claim nonetheless in there?
Well, if you take a look at the proposed judgment, all the judgment says is what the jury did. It essentially says that we were covered under both. There's nothing wrong with that, and in fact, a judgment is supposed to embody what the jury did, which is what this judgment said. This judgment said, we won verdicts under both, we're only taking under one of them because we couldn't recover both. Didn't say that last part, but conceptually that's the idea. There's nothing improper about submitting a judgment that embodied both, and indeed it was strange for the court to enter a judgment for Ford, the party that had not won a jury verdict. This was a totally kind of garden variety proposed judgment that stated simply what the jury's verdict had been. There's no election that's binding until we actually recover that amount. And so in an instance like this where, you know, the way down the line, Jamal's granted on one of the claims, there's no occasion for election of remedies.
Can I ask, what do you think is the next step, counsel? If we send it back to the trial court, what does Judge Barat do next?
Well, I think what happens is that the disposition from this court would be fairly straightforward. It would be that the trial court erred by entering judgment in favor of Ford on the implied warranty claim. Now, from our perspective, we're done. We won under the implied warranty claim, and indeed, after the jury delivered its verdict, we said that from our perspective, we've proved our claim, we've gotten our damage amount, we're done. Now, Ford may well file a motion wherein it seeks an equitable offset against that amount. They have not filed any such motion, but they might. They should be allowed to if they'd like to. They can file a Jamal motion as to the implied warranty claim. There was no live Jamal to be filed back when they renewed their 50B motion, because the judge, Judge Barat, had already entered judgment in Ford's favor prior to that JMAL. So there wasn't anything, there was no case or controversy at that point. So on remand, I would say that Ford would be permitted to do whatever it's going to do now that that claim is now in play again.
Including seeking the same relief it got on the express warranty claim.
In other words, see, filing a JMAL motion, yes.
Okay.
There was another question from the panel?
Yes. After the jury verdict, Ford wanted a, it seemed like they wanted a bench trial on the offset issue. What would that bench trial look like, and why did the Quinteros refuse to enter that?
Well, two things. First of all, the Quinteros didn't refuse to do anything. Nobody said, let's have this bench trial, and Quintero said, absolutely not, we won't show. Our position was there was that in order to save the courts in trouble, if the express warranty claim was going to be what we were taking under, then maybe the issues weren't worth kind of pursuing at that point in the interest of judicial economy. That's a legal argument. Certainly the court could have said, no, I'd like to now continue on and try this, so that, you know, go ahead for it, you can file that motion. For an equitable offset, which again is something they hadn't filed at that point. They'd indicated that they believed that they were entitled to one. We certainly don't think there's any such thing as an equitable offset under the Song-Beverly Act's implied warranty provisions. And what was the other part of your question? I'm sorry, I realized I only answered half of it.
What would a bench trial look like? It seems like an offset would have been just you take the two judgments and just subtract them, right? Or am I missing something?
I'm not sure what the basis for their equitable offset argument would be. I assume that it had something to do with the use of the vehicle, but certainly the point of it would have been that we would have, I'm not sure what the trial itself would have been. I mean, if what you're asking is whether there was a need for sort of just a legal determination whether such an offset was needed, and whether there'd be any kind of factual showing that would need to be tried by the judge, that I don't know. But certainly on as kind of a threshold question of whether or not they're even entitled to such a thing under the implied warranty provisions of the Song-Beverly Act, there would have been briefing, there would have been argument, presumably, and the judge would have ruled on whether there even is such a thing as an equitable offset.
I mean, one thing, even if you're right, one comment here is that this probably could have been clarified a little bit for the district court, because there was some meet and confers, which is not clear to me that they were that productive heading, you know, after the verdict. And I'm just not sure the district court appreciated your position that we should enter judgment on the express warranty. We don't need to deal with this implied warranty at this time. We should see what happens with any JMOL that Ford may file, and then we can return to the implied warranty. I understand your argument, but I also am somewhat sympathetic to the district court feeling like there was a lot of things flying around and it wasn't being presented clearly to him.
Well, I think a couple things on that. I think certainly at the point that we got our verdict, the court asked if there was anything from our perspective that needed to be done. And we said from our perspective, no, we've proved our claim. And then we went on to say that we can imagine that from Ford's perspective, that there might be some motion practice that it might want to go through on this, equitable offset issue, but that we might be able to simplify things. At the point that Ford then files its objection to the proposed judgment that the court had directed us to propose, and Ford says, we think you've abandoned your claim, notwithstanding the fact that we obtained a verdict on the claim. Our response to that, I think, was pretty clear to the court in stating that we didn't think there was abandonment. There was essentially an election to recover under one of them, which had the effect of rendering this other stuff moot for the time being. Now, it's true that at that point, maybe we should have gone the next step and said, well, and if you disagree with us, then maybe there'll be a need down the line, and court, you should, Judge Barat, you need to make a determination as to whether or not you'd like to move forward with these, at this point, sort of hypothetical questions, because, we're recovering under the express warranty claim. But if you don't, it sort of provided sort of a roadmap. You're right that, that maybe at that point we could have provided a roadmap, but it wasn't our affirmative defense. It wasn't our assertion, it's not even affirmative defense, it wasn't our offset claim. So I don't think that whatever confusion is there, we should be sort of tagged with fault in it. I mean, it's kind of looking back on it.
Not suggesting tagging, I'm more suggesting that I think there might have been a way to lay this out for the district court and to propose a sort of sequencing of decision-making that might have made this a little bit more straightforward in the district court.
Might have had an easier time. That's certainly the case, that everybody could have sat down and said it. Now, I think the problem, what happened, I think, is that the judge sort of prematurely jumped at entering judgment against the plaintiff, and that sort of sent things in a direction. If the court had stepped back, because Ford said, well, you know, either enter judgment in our favor or set this for a bench trial on our equitable offset issue. And the court sort of chose option A and committed itself to that position. And at that point, it sort of took things off into left field a bit, because at that point now there's no purpose for a JMAL. The court's already entered judgment on them on that claim. There's no kind of proceedings on an equitable offset issue because the court's already entered judgment for them on that claim. And so it sort of sent things off into left field. And sort of at each juncture along the way, the court sort of doubled down on that. We, you know, down the line filed our Rule 59 and 60 motion saying, well, now that the express warranty claim is off the table, we think your dismissal of the implied warranty claim, at that point, that probably would have been kind of the last available off-ramp to steer things back. But I think kind of whatever the ideology of all of this, whatever the genesis of all of this was, the one thing that can be said is that the court did sort of the one thing it couldn't do, which was to enter judgment before based on this notion that we had bindingly elected remedies away from a claim that we'd won.
How are the two claims different in terms of the facts, the express versus the implied? What's the difference?
Sure. So there are two different provisions under the Song-Beverly Act. These are sort of two different roads. One is this idea of express warranty claims where you have to present the car at least, you know, for a reasonable number of repair attempts. The damages are a statutorily set amount, the amount paid or payable on the vehicle minus a statutory deduction for the number of miles driven. The implied warranty claim is a different claim. It's a claim that basically kind of comes along with every purchase of a car, and the idea is that when you're sold a vehicle, you're promised that it's going to be like all the other cars on the road. It's going to be merchantable. It's essentially implied warranty of merchantability. So if the vehicle is sold with defects that you don't even have to manifest in the first year, but in this case, for example, we proved that this power shift transmission is a massively problematic thing, that you're entitled to damages. They're not statutorily set. In this case, we sought essentially to unwind the lease. So the damages overlapped, but the proof of the claims is different. You don't have to show that you brought it in a reasonable number of repair attempts. So there's different elements to each claim.
Question: if we agreed with you that the Quinteros did not abandon its implied warranty claim, is that enough to then just reverse the JMAL, or do we have to do any additional finding after that?
If the court concludes that the trial court erred by dismissing that claim, then there's no further findings. So we could just remand for further proceedings consistent with the court's disposition.
Well, did in the JMAL order, didn't the trial court essentially say that it also dismissed the implied warranty claim on the merits based off of the lack of not contesting it under the local rules?
Right, so two parts. The court did not say that, and I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, so I'll keep an eye on that.
We'll let you have time to do rebuttal.
I appreciate that. So what happened at the point that the court grants that JMAL is first of all, when it actually granted the JMAL, it only ruled on the express warranty claim and says, well, they abandoned on the implied warranty claim. After the fact, when we file our Rules 59 and 60 motions, the court comes back and says, actually, let me clarify. I actually granted also as the implied warranty claim on the basis that you didn't oppose it.
Right.
So it doesn't reach it on the merits. Never says that there was insufficient evidence. Never meets the JMAL standards. So two things. One, at the point that the court's ruling on that, it doesn't have anything before it to rule on. It had already granted, it already imposed judgment, it already entered judgment in Ford's favor on the claim. So issue isn't live. Number two, at the point that it's doing that, it's not complying with the JMAL standards. It's not saying there's insufficient evidence. Whatever the local rule is on whether or not you file an opposition can't trump what Rule 50 says, and that's the Martinez case, which is a summary judgment case, but it basically says a local rule that says if you don't file an opposition, you can't kind of divest the court of its responsibility to actually comply with the statutory standards for tossing a verdict.
Right. So it sounds like, though, you're suggesting that we do need to go do a step further than saying that the district court erred on the abandonment issue, that we also then have to look at the JMAL on implied warranty.
I think that the court doesn't need to do that because there was no act of J-Mal at any point before the court. So, in effect, the court doesn't need to do that because the point that Ford filed its J-Mal motion, the court had already entered judgment for Ford. So there was no valid J-Mal motion before the district court at the point that it was ostensibly ruling on it as to the implied warranty claim. It had already entered judgment for Ford on the implied warranty.
At least we have to rule that there was no active J-Mal on the implied warranty.
Yeah, that's one way, correct. That's one way the court could go. The court could also say that whatever happened there, the court couldn't allow a local rule to trump the J-Mal standards. It couldn't say, and again, and frankly, we did oppose. We filed an opposition, and that local rule just says if you don't file a document. Well, we filed a document that said we were opposing J-Mal, so, you know, arguably we didn't actually even fail to comply with the local rule. But the shortest distance between two points is certainly to say there was no active J-Mal before the court when it ostensibly ruled.
I know we've taken you right to the end of your time, but I actually have another question for you. Has there been a ruling in this MDL on the legal validity of the implied warranty claim and then the set-off issue?
Not that I know of. I actually don't know. Not that I know of.
Okay, I'm trying to understand the significance of this appeal because if we send it back, those rulings would presumably get made, and I'm trying to just understand what's at stake in this particular appeal, whether it's broader than just the Quintero's abandonment or whether this would then be poised to issue a ruling. The district court would issue a ruling that would then possibly be relevant to a host of other cases.
I don't know the answer. I'm happy to find out the answer and submit a letter to the court with that information, but I don't want to shoot from the hip and give you incorrect information.
Okay. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal because we kept you on the run there, but let's hear from your opposing counsel.
And I would appreciate a little bit of time for rebuttal so I can address any issues.
We'll leave you 2 minutes. Thank you.
Otherwise, I realize I'm at the end of my time, and so I will, let my friend have
thank you. Yeah, we will put 2 minutes on the clock for you. Mr. Chesson, good morning.
May it please the court. Scott Chesson, you're Chuck Harding for Ford. I hope you can hear me. I had to walk off screen to hit the mute button. Your Honors, the plaintiffs made a conscious choice to stop litigating their implied warranty claim before any amount of damages had been determined and before they were entitled to judgment on that claim. That is not an election of remedies. It is an abandonment of an incomplete claim. The district court was well within its discretion to so hold, and it was certainly within its discretion to grant a motion for judgment that was unopposed in any form. So we think this court should affirm. Now, I'm happy to answer questions on anything the court wants to discuss, but hearing none, I'll start, I think, essentially where Ms. Thompson has started, which is, you know, at least the first question that both parties have presented to this case, which is whether the plaintiff's actions constituted an abandonment, or as the district court held, or an election of remedies, as plaintiff has argued ably this morning. Here's how this court has defined abandonment. I'm reading from the Bank of America case. The court said that a party abandons a claim when it has had a full and fair opportunity to ventilate its views with respect to an issue, and instead chooses a position that removes that issue from the case. That is precisely what the plaintiffs did with respect to both the legal and the factual issue on Ford's affirmative defense here. With respect to my colleague on the other side, it is not true, as Ms. Tobisman said, that the claim had been litigated to completion and all that was left was to choose between remedies. What was left, as the district court held initially and again post-trial, was both a legal determination about the validity of this defense and then a factual determination about how it applied in this case.
Okay, let's try this again. Mr. Chesson, can you hear us?
I can.
Okay, good. That's going to make the argument go a little better. Thank you.
Well, Judge Press, just give us 5 more minutes. We almost have this settled.
Yeah.
We've been working in your absence.
No, I Judge Lasnik, you played the role of waiting for the next act to come on stage, and we appreciate that, but it took us a little longer here. So, okay, Mr. Chess, I do apologize for the technical difficulties. You have 12 minutes on the clock, but we're not going to hold you to that. I'm not going to reset the clock, but I want to make sure we have a full opportunity to hear your argument and to ask our questions. And so why don't I begin with where I was trying to get in, which is you recited the standard for abandonment, and I guess I'm having difficulty seeing the abandonment. It seems to me more like trying to have your cake and eat it too with the proposed judgment. The proposed judgment requested a judgment on the implied warranty claim. I agree with you that that claim was not litigated to completion. But the plaintiffs basically didn't think that was necessary. They had a verdict on the express warranty claim. That verdict was more money. And the proceedings on that weren't done either. You had more to say. Your client had more to say on that claim, too, and you did. And you ended up winning on that. But from the plaintiff's perspective, I think they had a larger dollar amount on the express warranty, so they didn't. I think their position was, why are we going to have all these additional proceedings on the implied warranty until we have the express warranty claim shake out? So why don't you respond?
I certainly agree with much of Your Honor's characterization about at least what the plaintiffs were attempting to accomplish. And certainly I agree that they used, throughout this, they used the language of, we are simply electing a remedy. But the judge's holding, which should have come as absolutely no surprise to the collective, because it was the position that Ford had taken repeatedly, both throughout the meet and confer process and then in proceeding, written proceedings before the court, what the judge held was the act of insisting that the remaining proceedings were moot and saying that the court should enter judgment without resolving these issues was a knowing relinquishment, a conscious relinquishment of a known right. And I've been speaking a lot consciously in the language of discretion. And I know there's a battle in the briefs, and there often is, about what this court's standard of review is, the abuse of discretion is de novo, and often those disputes are, some of the angels dancing on the head of a pin. But I think here it's for real and it's substantive. The abandonment case, the cases that we were just discussing, they talk about a judge's ability to deem a party's actions to be an abandonment as growing out of the court's inherent authority to manage its docket. Ms. Thomason said, we were solely concerned with judicial economy. I could take her at her word, but I'm not.
What would have happened if the plaintiffs had sent you a proposed judgment that said, here's the judgment on the express warranty claim, and on the implied warranty claim, dismissed without prejudice, subject to further rulings on the express warranty claim. Is that abandonment too?
We would be in a very different position. There are a lot of things that the plaintiff could have done. They could have asked for a judgment to be entered under Rule 54B, partially final judgment, because, if they were truly interested in sequencing things, that would have been a safe way to do it. That's what the parties did in that Far West case that's discussed.
This is what I'm trying to get at. This was the plaintiff's fatal move, asking for too much in the judgment, and then all of a sudden that becomes recharacterized as an abandonment.
It's not simply, I think the simple answer to your question is that's one of them, but it's not simply that. It's the position that they took in response to the objection. This was, as Ms. Thompson said, and I agree, this was fully briefed before the district court, before this, ruling was made, where Ford made its position clear, and the plaintiffs made their position clear. They said, we do not think any further proceedings on this claim are warranted. And where I was going before we had our unfortunate technological episode was, this was an issue of consequence that could have been resolved early in the MDL with very little effort by either party. The legal question of whether this type of defense is available in this type of case had been briefed several times over the course of pre-trial and mid-trial proceedings on jury instructions and whatnot. Both parties had laid out their claims. All the evidence was in response to a question. I think it was Judge Bumate who posed this question. There wouldn't have been a bench trial. All the witnesses had testified, the judge had heard it all. All we were asking for was resolve this legal issue and apply it to the facts of this case, a case where the plaintiffs sought to revoke their lease 6 weeks before the end of a 3-year lease. And Ford's contention in this case, which would have reverberated through an MDL with 1,000 other cases, many of which have now been resolved without this issue having been adjudicated, Ford's position was, even if you can prove breach of implied warranty to a jury, you're still not entitled to recover because you have received, when we're talking equitably, not statutorily, you have received the benefit of having, you know, possessed and used this car for 3 years.
Is it your client's position that even, is it your client's position that with the set-off, you would zero them out on the implied warranty claim?
Yes, that is that. I don't know whether we would have prevailed on that or not. Nobody does. But that is the position that Ford would have taken. That is the position that Ford previewed throughout the trial and up to this point. And my point is, this is why I started talking about abuse of discretion versus de novo. If the concern from the plaintiff was truly nothing more than it's more efficient to do it in this order rather than that order, maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong. Ford had a different position on what would have been efficient. That decision.
But why would it have been more efficient at once you got the verdict and the express warranty claim had a higher dollar value? Why would it have been more efficient to litigate the implied warranty claim? I mean, it seems to me you'd want to litigate the express warranty claim and find out if there's any there. And if there's not, then turn to the implied warranty claim, which has less value to plaintiffs.
I understand the question. The answer is because this was a bellwether trial and there was more at stake in the resolution of these issues than simply, you know, the Quintero's claim. And so my point is, with eyes open, the plaintiffs made a choice to take the position that no further proceedings were necessary because they were no longer pursuing a remedy for the breach of implied warranty. That was their right. But the judge, in the exercise of saying, this is how I want to structure litigation in this MDL, had the discretion to say, if you want to take that position has consequences. And that decision by the district court is then reviewed by this court for abuse of discretion because of the nature of the decision that the court made.
Did the district court set that out as that's the consequences of your election, that you would be abandoning the implied warranty claim forever? It seems like it just kind of happened after the fact and everyone was surprised by it.
I cannot imagine how the plaintiffs could have been surprised by it. I mean, I suppose, to read a bit into your question, it's true that there was no oral argument on this motion. So the judge, the first words from the judge were, I'm holding this as an abandonment. But the judge, and Wisconsin adverted to this in her argument, I think the judge rests with this too. The judge was taking Ford up on a suggestion that it made clearly in the briefs, like the position was laid out before the court, immediately after the verdict, and then through the meet and confer process, which was documented and submitted to the court, and then in briefing, where Ford said, these are the two options. Either we proceed to finish this claim, or the court should hold that it has been abandoned and we should move on, and the court chose option B. And my point is, the court had the discretion to do so.
But why do you even want this? I mean, you would win this case, but your client wants a ruling on some key legal issues on the implied warranty. So that seemed to be what you actually wanted. You wanted to litigate this below. That was your first order of preference.
And I think the answer is we wanted it at the time, which was 2 years ago, and a lot of water has passed under the bridge. And I like this toast, but I'm not as up on the ins and outs of the MDL as it has progressed in the last 2 years. But I have it on good authority that the consequences of the decision now would be very different from the consequences of the decision had it been made 2 years ago when it was in the context of a trial that was designed to set precedents for, you know, further litigation in the MDL. So that's our position on the abandonment issue. And with the court's indulgence in the 2 minutes or so I have left, I would like to touch on the second decision point here, because I just want to tell you, ask, well, if we disagree with you on abandonment, is this over? I respect that. I think the answer is no. There are two rulings on appeal here, and one of them is Judge Barat's decision to grant judgment as a matter of law on this claim. And it is our position that he had the authority to do that at the time it was presented to him, and he had the authority to deem the complete lack of a response to be a violation of the local rule. You have to understand the sequence of events here. At the time, before the case was submitted to the jury, Ford submitted a 50A motion in which it moved for judgment on both of his claims, briefed them extensively. There was no response from the plaintiff. I don't fault them for that. That often, in a rush of trial, you often don't submit a response at that point. Then it went to verdict. Then Ford renewed and was extraordinarily clear. It said, we understand that there has been this, I'm not even sure if you read the language of this judgment, I'm not sure that the judge did technically grant judgment for Ford. It doesn't say it's judgment for Ford. It's embodied in a document that says final judgment. But what the language actually says is the court is holding that this claim has been abandoned. So I'm not sure if it's final judgment for Ford or an interlocutory ruling, but whatever it was, Ford filed a motion and said, we are renewing our motion for judgment as a matter of law because we have substantial grounds for doing so. And just in case the threshold ruling gets overruled, we would like the court to rule on this. Now, Plaintiff argues that the court didn't have Article III jurisdiction to adjudicate that claim. And respectfully, I don't think that's how Article III jurisdiction works. A claim becomes moot for constitutional purposes if intervening events mean that the plaintiff no longer has standing to bring the claim. The plaintiff is no longer injured, or the court lacks the ability to redress a wrong. The plaintiffs here still claim to have been injured by a breach of warranty, and if they were to prevail on their legal arguments, the court has the power to redress that injury. There's Article III standing for, jurisdiction for the district court to review the claim.
No, yeah, I think you make good arguments here. I mean, I guess the more difficult part for you on this is that, especially in the order denying the plaintiff's motion to amend the judgment, the district court really does loop back to the earlier abandonment, and so I find it somewhat difficult to disentangle these two things and treat the JAMAL proceedings as wholly detached from the earlier finding that there was an abandonment.
Here's how you can do it. I hear what you're saying, but I'll say this. Put aside that even if we give the plaintiffs a pass on the writing, which I don't think we should, a motion was filed, I think they had an obligation to respond. There was a hearing. It's in the supplemental excerpts of record, it starts at page 56, on the motion for judgment as a matter of law. That hearing begins with the district court, before anybody speaks, with the district court saying, I've read the papers, I am inclined at the very least to grant a new trial because I have grave concerns about the way the evidence came in this case, and I am seriously considering granting judgment as a matter of law. He then proceeds to ask very pointed questions of plaintiff's counsel about the sufficiency of the evidence on express warranty. It goes on for 30 pages. At no point during that hearing does plaintiff ever say, wait, if you're going to grant judgment on express warranty, then you have to consider our arguments with respect to implied warranty. So when you say to judge, it's all tangled up, I agree, but I think Judge Barat's point was, I was within my rights to construe this course of behavior from the plaintiffs, starting from the day the verdict was entered, all the way through the hearing on JMOL. I'm entitled to construe that as the plaintiffs, for whatever their strategic reasons, are no longer pursuing these claims. And for the plaintiffs to raise half their brief on appeal, to be making brand new arguments that they've never made in any form to the district judge, suggests that this is a change of course that shouldn't be counted. So that's how I can keep talking to the cows in a moment. I see.
Let me see if my colleagues have any further questions for you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chesney.
I'm not off screen to move.
Quite all right. Apologies again. Ms. Tobisman, we'll be pleased to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple things. The court absolutely put its finger on the issue on whether there was did Judge Barat say, if you elect this remedy, you will be abandoning the other remedy. No, you did not say that. All that happened in this case is that we submitted a judgment that the court directed us to present that stated what the jury did, which was that we won on both, and we were now having done that. Now we were collecting under one. That's it. He says, well, there's this course of conduct. There's no course of conduct. Literally, at that point, the court enters judgment in Ford's favor, and we're off to the races. The notion that it, way down the line, when Ford renews its JMAL motion, that we could have said or done anything that would have had any effect on this abandonment that the court had concluded had occurred months earlier is just kind of a chronological disconnect.
But why wasn't why wasn't anything raised to Judge Barat in that hearing?
I wasn't in the hearing. I don't know what strategic, if anything. I mean, our view at that point was that the implied warranty claim was just gone. And indeed, Ford had no business filing a JMAL motion that raised the implied warranty, and Judge Barat had no case or controversy. I mean, separate from kind of Article III standing, you're talking about whether or not, was there any remedy that Judge Barat could have offered them at that point that he hadn't already given them? No, he'd already entered judgment in Ford's favor months earlier. So I don't know what was said at that point, but I don't think that making or not making a legal argument in a JMAL hearing months later can have any effect on whether or not the standard is an intentional relinquishment of a known right with knowledge of the facts. And at the point that we submitted a proposed judgment, that was sort of the original sin in this case, was that we had submitted a proposed judgment that said we're going to elect to recover under one of two remedies that we agreed was overlapping. That was the original sin. That's a known relinquishment. At that point, we had every reason to believe that the express warranty claim was going to hold up. The court, let's remember, sat on the Rule 50A motion that was made during trial. It doesn't get around to ruling on it until after the jury delivers its verdict, says, I've now considered that first JMAL motion, I deny it. So we have every reason to believe that it's going to hold up. Ford is.
I think we have your argument. We've let you go a little over, but I'm going to check with my colleagues to see if they have questions. Okay. I want to thank you, Ms. Tobesman, Mr. Chesson. I want to thank you as well. We very much appreciate the arguments in this case, and this matter is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.